Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Tonight, we have a lecture presented by the Department of International Relations titled, Turkey, Yes We Can. Speaking will be Turkish journalist Mustafa Aykal. We begin with an introduction by Boston University Anthropology Department Professor of International Relations, Augustus Norton.
It's now my pleasure to introduce the speaker for tonight, Mustafa Aykal, who has traveled from Turkey. He's a journalist. For those of you who follow Turkish politics, you know his blog, The White Pass, which is usually a very sort of interesting place to gain his astute impressions about Turkish politics and developments. He's also the opinion editor at the Turkish Daily News, which is the oldest English newspaper in Turkey. And he writes frequently for Newsweek, for the Weekly Standard, and other U.S. periodicals. You'll find links to some of his articles on the lecture website. And it's my pleasure to welcome him here tonight to talk about Turkey. The title of his lecture is Yes, We Can. So sort of looking at Turkey today and looking into the future, perhaps with certain inspiration from political personalities who are not particularly Turkish, but certainly have been in Turkey recently. So, Mustafa, it's a great pleasure to welcome you to Boston University and to turn over the podium to you. Please join me in welcoming Mustafa Aykal.
Well, good evening, everybody. It's a pleasure to be here, and I should thank, first of all, to those people who made this event possible. Well, tonight's topic is Turkey, Yes, We Can, and it is referring to the future of Turkey. But I believe that to understand the future and the contemporary affairs, you need to look at history, especially if you're coming from the old world, where we're coming from. History makes a lot of sense. It explains a lot of things. Well, to understand Turkey, one needs to, first of all, look at the Ottoman Empire. I mean, one of the important things which define Turkey, which Turkey struggles with at the same time, but also has taken a lot of things, is the Ottoman Empire. And as you know, the Ottoman Empire was one of the great empires of the world. It survived for almost six centuries. And until its very end, the geography that we call the Middle East today was basically the Ottoman Empire. It had also a foot in the Balkans for a long time, but steadily it went back. In the 19th century, the empire started to lose land, and bits and pieces of the empire started to become independent. The French Revolution, waves of nationalism, and different components of the empire gaining their independence. So it's a long story of decline from one perspective. But also the 19th century of the Ottoman Empire is also not a story of decline when you look at the idea of modernization, when you look at how modernization unfolded in Ottoman history. Before maybe going to that, I should remind that the Ottoman Empire was not a Turkish state. Today, the Turkish Republic is defined as a Turkish state, but the Ottoman Empire was a multi-ethnic and multi-religious entity. Of course, Turks had the upper hand, but they did not even define themselves ethnically as Turks. So the language, the Ottoman language, was Turkish grammar mixed with Arabic and Persian words and written in Arabic script. So it was Islam was an important identity, definitely. It was the official identity. But non-Muslim elements of the empire had their own space and they could survive. In fact, the Jews found it much more preferable to Europe and came to the Ottoman Empire, a well-known fact in history. So this multi-ethnic, multi-religious identity of the empire started to disintegrate, as I said, because of modernity, because of nationalism. Because every component in the empire, one by one, started to say, hey, we are not Ottomans, we are Serbians. We want our Serbian state. We are not Ottomans, we are Bulgarians, we are Greeks. And it went on and on and on. And finally, the empire collapsed, and because of its military defeat in World War I. The Ottomans unfortunately chose the wrong side and allied with themselves with the Germans. Lost the war. And at the end of World War I, the Ottoman Empire disintegrated. And what happened was that a new modern republic was created from the ashes, if you will, of the empire. This is an ambiguous story. It was a step towards modernization, the creation of Turkey, the Turkish Republic. But modernization is also a painful process, and it created some dynamics which continue to be problematic to date. So let me dwell on that a little bit. But before even going to that, I should say one more thing about the Ottoman Empire. I refer to the modernization of the Ottoman Empire. This is also important today to understand the dynamics between Islam and modernity. There has been a great deal of discussion of Islam and it's compatible with democracy and freedom and the idea of a modern, secular system, the idea of civil liberties recently in the West and especially in the United States. And there are some skeptical writers who say, Islam is not compatible with democracy because Islam demands that there should be an Islamic state which imposes religion, and non-Muslims are by definition second-class citizens according to the medieval Islamic understanding of, protected people, the Zimmis under Islamic rule. So that, in fact, actually, if you look at the Ottoman Empire, what you see is that all these traditional Islamic concepts have been reformed in the 19th century. In the 19th century, with the beginning of the Tanzimat period, 1839, the Ottomans started to adopt Western ways and synthesize them with Islam, or at least made them acceptable to an Islamic understanding. This started by, of course, adopting science and technology, but over time, the Ottomans started to get Western legal systems and political systems. And, for example, that included the idea of equal citizenship. The Zimmi status, the protected status, which is a protected but somewhat second-class status, which was given to non-Muslims in the Islamic age, was abolished by the Ottomans with the Islahat decree of 1859, and Jews and Christians were given equal citizenship. Actually, the fez, the famous red fez of the Ottoman Empire, was a symbol of this unity among Ottoman citizens, because in the past, all faiths would wear a headgear according to their belief, and Muslim headgear would be different from the Jewish headgear, and the Christian one would be different. But the fez came as this modern identity of all Ottomans, which they would wear and which would symbolize them. That's why the Ottoman Empire, again, with the same modernization process, established a constitutional monarchy in 1876. And the empire accepted a constitution before Russia, Portugal, or Spain. Today, there are some Islamists which say Quran is the constitution. Well, the Ottomans didn't say that. They accepted a constitution which respected the Quran. There was a clause about that. But also which limited the sultans of the power, which established liberties for the citizens, which established a parliament in which Jewish and Armenian and other non-Muslim elements of the empire was also represented. So when we look at the Ottoman Empire, we should not fall into the mistake of, from my point of view, seeing it as a dark age in which the Republic came as a shining sun out of nowhere. I mean, the Republic, of course, was a big step forward in Turkey's modernization history, but it also owed its roots to the Ottoman Empire. And one interesting thing is that while all these reforms were being made in the 19th century in the Ottoman Empire, Ottoman intellectuals were thinking about them and justifying them from, for example, an Islamic point of view. Namık Kemal, for example, a late Ottoman intellectual, defended democracy from an Islamic point of view. And he said, the will of God is expressed through the will of people. And, some of the dichotomies between Islam and democracy, which people think that exists today, was actually sorted out by Ottoman intellectuals way back in late 19th century. But anyway, the empire fell, and the story ended with World War I. And as I said, after a war of liberation, because even Anatolia was occupied by foreign powers, especially the Greeks. So Turkey fought a war of liberation, and the hero of that war, Mustafa Kemal Atatürk, became then the leader of the country, the first president. And the Turkish Republic, as we know today, with its borders, Well, there was a few ambiguities in Mosul and Hatay, but they were sorted out later. But the modern Turkish Republic was created in 1922 and 23, and it became a republic. But here's an interesting thing. A republic doesn't necessarily mean a democracy. A republic can be democratic or non-democratic. And when the Turkish Republic was founded, actually, in 1923, you could have called it a democracy because there was a parliament which was elected by the representatives of the people from all different parts of the country. And when the republic was founded, soon two political parties emerged. One was the People's Republican Party, headed by Atatürk and İsmet İnönü and the people who, you know, sympathize with their political vision. And the other party was, it was just established 6 months later, this People's Republican Party. It was called Terakkiperver Fırka in Turkish, or Progressive Party. It was created by Kazım Karabekir, which was another war hero. Atatürk was definitely the war hero, but Kazım Karabekir was also a general who fought in the East and who was well respected, and there were other important people in the party. So these two parties started to compete with each other for a short time. And when you looked at the programs of the parties, there were some differences. The People's Republican Party, which still survives today and which has been the core of Turkish politics, or the central line of Turkish political life. To date, it's arguably, it's referred to this idea of modernization by a revolution and by the state's hand. So the people had to be modernized, the state should take the action. They were very much inspired by the French Revolution and the French Enlightenment. It was one political view. On the other side, the Progressive Party was more conservative. They believed in modernization, but they believed in a more progressive, evolutionary, not revolutionary, modernization. And there was one clause in the founding charter of the Terakkiperver Fırka, this progressive party. It said, our party is respectful to religious beliefs. And what happened was, 6 months later, in the very beginning of 1925, there was a big Kurdish revolt. And I will come to its reasons in a minute. There was a big Kurdish revolt against the Republic, and the government, which was at the hands of the People's Republican Party, decided to establish an extraordinary law, a martial law, and all political opposition, including this Progressive Party, was banned. And there was so Turkey entered into the single party period, as we call it. And this single party period went from 1925 to 1946, so 20 years of single party period. And of course, the Progressive Party was banned. Its leaders, some of them were put in house prison, so because they were seen as enemies of the revolution. And in this 20 year period, from 25 to 46, 21 year period, Atatürk was the president until 38, and he passed away in 38, and then İsmet İnönü became the president. And İsmet İnönü continued to be the president until 1950. So actually, you can continue this period until 1950, a quarter of a century, from 25 to 50. This is the formative period of the Turkish Republic. And to be honest, it was not a democratic period. Because by definition, a revolution and democracy, there's a tension between them. I mean, if you are carrying a revolution, if you are saying we are recreating the society based on an ideal, you cannot also look at what society is saying sometimes. It was an authoritarian period. But what happened in this authoritarian period? Well, it was a wave of modernization, to be sure. And some of the things which we appreciate today, like women's rights, or like some of the modern styles, like some new laws were adopted. Civil codes was adopted from Switzerland. So Turkey has been modernized, but this modernization came not from the society itself, but it came from the state. And the thing is, this modernization effort was defined quite narrowly, if you will, because it was equated by being Western. So modernization and westernization was seen as equal things. Whereas arguably you can say, well, we can have a non-Western modernization. Well, the idea didn't exist at the time. It's a newer idea. And so So when I say modernization, for example, I can understand about building new roads and factories and creating a better economy or something. That's one thing, and it was there. But also modernization was meant to change the way of life of the society and make the society adopt Western ways of life. And the most iconic example of this attitude, of this revolution, was the Hatch Revolution of 1925, in which the Ottoman fez was banned, and all traditional headgears were banned, and bowler hats were introduced, and they were the only thing you were supposed to wear. And for the conservative masses in Anatolia, the bowler hat represented an alien civilization, like the Western civilization, and they didn't want to wear it. So there were like clashes in the country. A few people were executed for not wearing the hat or like standing against or riding against the hat revolution. And similar revolutionary efforts continued. In the 30s, for example, for a period, Turkish music was banned in Turkish radios and only Western operas and, you know, Western music could be played because that was the modern way of, you know, being. So these are some of the excesses. I'm just trying to give you a picture. So the people who look back at the Kemalist period and today, Turkey, some people say, well, that was necessary because we had to modernize the nation, and it was basically a peasant society which was living in a pre-modern age, so some state enforcement was necessary. And that's one view. Another view would be to say, well, yes, modernization is a good thing, but the way to modernize is not just to impose a new culture, but allow the existing culture to build up itself. And focusing on the economy and education aspects, and allow the society to evolve. And these are two disputed models. And, you know, you can choose whatever you want. You can say it was the rightful thing to do or it was not the rightful thing to do, but that's a fact of history. But we should also note that, like, in that period, Atatürk did a lot of reforms, and he faced a few challenges when he was like realizing these reforms and creating this new nation, the new man, you know, the new Turk out of the Ottoman. One idea was secularism. Secularism meant that religion should be out of public life. It was accepted in private life, so everybody had the right to go and pray to a mosque, and, you know, private life was fine. But in public life, religion was not accepted. So right 1 year after the foundation of the Republic in 1924, in this single-party period, Sufi orders were banned. To date, in Turkey, Sufi orders are banned. I mean, they exist. Everybody knows that they exist. But they kind of have to, you know, use euphemistic names and to sometimes hide themselves. And there has been political periods which there is a tendency to crack down upon them, or there are periods which they are safer. So this tradition. So there has always been a tension between the state, the secular state, and the religious groups, because the state simply didn't want the religious groups to exist, and this made the religious groups, at least seemingly, anti-secular. And then the state said, these are anti-secular, we don't want these forces. And those forces says, well, the state is repressing us. So there's this always continuing tension between the Kemalist state, especially the ideology, and the religious groups. Another tension, which started again in the 1920s, and which still continues to haunt today deeply, is the Kurdish question. The Kurds were a component of the Ottoman Empire, and until the very end, the Kurds actually supported the empire. In World War I, in the War of Liberation, 1920s, the Kurds fought with the Turks against the enemy. And the enemy was basically the others, the infidels, I mean, the French or Armenians or Russians or Greeks, or in Gallipoli, the French or the British, the other. So there were like this Muslim solidarity between Turks and Kurds. Don't forget, the Ottoman Empire was not a Turkish state. It was an Ottoman state. When the Ottoman Empire turned into a Turkish state, and Turkishness became the new emphasized identity, and when Islam lost its preeminence as the bond between Turks and Kurds, a new secular identity was introduced. Kurds felt themselves not very well represented in this new order, and that's not a surprise. right after Republic 1923. You have a big Kurdish revolt in 1925. It was an Islamic and Kurdish, you know, mixed revolt. I mean, it was a revolt led by a Kurdish sheikh. So, but that revolt was cracked down by the state with strong measures. And then years and years, every year until the 1940s, you had a Kurdish revolt every year in Turkey. And one of them was in the city of Dersim, which was a tragic event. The revolt was suppressed by warplanes bombing the city, and you know there were many civilian casualties. So, and the name of Dersim was changed into Tunceli. It's like a still a problematic city in Turkey, as people who know Turkey would know. So, what I'm saying is this: the Republic came as a modernization effort and as a also homogenization effort. So from the Ottoman identity, which was multi-ethnic and multi-religious, a new Turkish identity was created, but not everybody was in favor of this new identity. Some people were, some people liked it, and they adopted the new ways and the new system, and some people did not. And the people and the segments of society who had a hard time in adopting these this new way, this new system and new identity, can be basically, a big chunk would be conservative Muslims, and the other big part would be Kurds. But we should also say that the Kurdish reaction has been violent at most times. Like, I mean, it was democratic too, but the among the Kurds, you had armed rebellions and finally a terrorist organization in the 1980s, the PKK, whereas the Islamic resistance to the system was more on the democratic side. And basically what the conservative Muslims did was to wait for elections and vote for the party which promises more religious freedom, which promises to, you know, soften the secularism of the state. So this single-party period went until 1950, as I said. In 1950, in 1946, Turkey changed from single-party to multi-party system, and there was a good reason. The Allies won Second World War, and democracy was a new fashion, and you know Turkey had to adopt, and Turkey adopted. So in 1946, İsmet İnönü said that, you know, we are accepting this multi-party system, and Democrat Party was founded in 1946. And interestingly, this Democrat Party was, in my view, and in the view of some other scholars, was arguably a continuation of the Progressive Party, which was closed down in 1926. It was, in the terms of Turkish politics, a center-right party. It believed in a less repressive secularism. It respected, you know, it was not willing to crack down on Sufis and other religious groups. It was more lenient towards Kurdish identity. Hence, the Democratic Party would bring some Kurdish notables into the parliament in the 1950s. And its emphasis was on economic progress. Whereas the People's Party, the Kemalist emphasis, was on cultural progress, culture being adopting the Western ways of life. Whereas the Democratic Party's emphasis was on new factories, you know, getting the Marshall, plan, and you know, boosting agriculture in Anatolia and building dams and so on. And these two ways of understanding of modernization, in which one cultural and the other one was economic, still continues in Turkey. From the CHP's perspective, that is very important. You should have the right manners, the Western manners, to act in a social environment. But the AKP, which is, again, a continuation of the center-right, more Anatolian party, which gets votes from the unwashed masses, is not that, you know, refined in those manners. But they're doing good in economy. I mean, they know how to play with the market. They know how to, build and, you know, do things. Like, they're engineers. They're like this more... The tension goes on between the cultural understanding of modernization and the more economic and pragmatic, if you will, understanding of modernization. Anyway, in 1950, what happened? This Democrat Party came to power with a slogan, "Enough, the nation has the word." Because in the 30s, the CHP had used another slogan, which was very controversial, and it was not very open, but they were using it like jokingly. They said, "We are a party for the people, in spite of the people." Because, like, the people doesn't have the wisdom to understand that our ways are good. So people needs to be re-educated first to understand that our ways are good. So we have to act in spite of them, but ultimately we are acting for their benefit. So that was the argument. But in 1950, the Democrat Party came saying, "Enough, the nation has the word." And it was a big time of economic progress in Turkish history, in the first 5 years especially. in the latter part of the Democrat Party, things politically became tense. The Democrat Party itself showed some authoritarian measures about, like, banning some, you know, censoring the press at times and so on. And the tension increased and increased. And an important actor stepped in, which would shape the rest of, you know, Turkish history to date. That's the military. Because, I mean, during the single-party period, the state was, the party which was ruling the state was the People's Republican Party. It was the Kemalist party, so it was based on the revolutionary idea. But when CHP was ousted from power by this democratically elected Democratic Party, which started to shift the policy, someone had to say something. Someone had to save the revolution. Someone had to fight this counter-revolution, as they said. And it turned out that it was the military's job. In 1960, the military staged a coup against the Democrat Party. It was only against this party. I mean, the CHP was not close or something. After a show trial, to be honest, the prime minister was executed with two of his ministers, and the Democrat Party was banned. And in 1961, new elections took place. The CHP was favored by the system, and CHP was installed again as the, you know, governing. 4 years later, a new election happened. The party which continued the Democratic Party, Justice Party, came to power. There was another military coup in 1971. The Justice Party was again thrown out. I mean, and in 1980, the Justice Party was again in power. It was thrown again by the military. So, interestingly, all military coups in Turkey have been made against center-right parties in power. Because the center-right somewhat, because of its tendency to be more lenient on religious groups, because of its tendency to not continue the zeal of the revolution, doesn't fit into the, you know, the standards desired by the military. To be honest, we should also mention that in the 70s, the discussion also shifted towards this worry against Marxism, because in the late 60s and 70s, Turkey was also caught between this fight between the Marxist groups and the nationalist groups, and people were really fearing a Soviet occupation. So the military coup of 1980 was also linked with this fear from communism. So it was a more of a right-wing coup. But again, the party in power, which was the Justice Party, which was a center-right party. The 1980 coup is also like a new beginning in Turkish political life. For 3 years, the military regime went on, and tens of thousands of people have been tortured from all walks of life, from all political persuasions, right wings and the leftists. Basically, the state wanted to say, I don't want any political nonsense anymore, so everybody should follow the state's line. So all political activists were taken in and tortured and, you know, put in prison for years. And especially in the Kurdish areas, the suppression and the torture was most severe. And that boosted the PKK, which was a tiny group. The PKK stands for the Kurdistan Workers' Party, but it's a terrorist group, terrorists as recognized by the US and EU too. And it started as a Kurdish separation movement to fight against the system and create an independent Kurdistan. It just minimized its demands right now, but it's still a terrorist group. But the PKK's origin, as many experts argue, are in the in Turkish torture chambers. The people who had that repression in the 80s, early 80s, just went down to join the group and to take revenge. And a guerrilla war started, which claims 35,000 casualties up to date, and, you know, it's going on. Like, it's lost its impetus, but still people are dying because of PKK attacks. And the anti-PKK war, like the counterinsurgency war of the state, has been very bloody too, which included burnt villages and some PKK sympathizers, extrajudicial killings, and killed by state forces. So there's a nasty war which went on in Turkey's southeast. But in the 80s, this Kurdish question came back again to the fore because of the PKK's basically presence. And another thing was this: in the 80s, the issue of Islam again came back to the fore. Because when if you remember, like I said, in the beginning of the Republic, there was a tension between the conservative Islamic groups and the Kurds between this new regime. This died out a little bit in the Cold War. Because in the Cold War, the new dynamic was communists versus, you know, the non-communists. But when the Cold War ended and communism in Turkey basically died as a force, the old, you know, rivalries came back, the Kurdish identity again came back, the Islamic identity came back to the fore, and the tensions between these groups and the state again dominated Turkish politics. But again, there was a big difference. The Kurdish opposition via the PKK was violent. There were non-violent Kurdish opposition figures. There are still, but they remained tiny, so PKK and its political wing dominated the Kurdish opposition. Whereas on the Islamic camp, there was no violence. Secondly, there was a Turkish Hezbollah in the southeast, but it is a very shady organization, basically created by state forces against the PKK among the religious Kurds. So that's an exception. But other than that, the Islamic opposition, if you will, remained political, democratic, and interestingly, it became growingly pro-European. It became growingly pro-liberal, even if you will. And that's one of the interesting stories that's coming out of Turkey in the past few decades, and I just want to dwell upon that a little bit. Political Islam is a big debate. Everybody's speaking about political Islam these days after September 11, and there are good reasons for it. And we know that there are many different phenomena under this big tent called political Islam, and there are like totally nihilistic terrorist groups like Al-Qaeda, which is on the very margins. But there are other, and that's very marginal. And in the mainstream of political Islam, you would have parties like Ikhwan al-Muslimin in Egypt, like the Muslim Brotherhood, and their goal would be basically to come to power by democratic means and somehow Islamize the system, like establish some sort of Sharia or bring in some Sharia-based values and use the state in order to create a more Islamic society. That's the basic idea of political Islam. This doesn't have to be violent. It is, most of the time, it is not violent, but it is not liberal either. I mean, it's not, you don't create a liberal political system by making Islam the doctrine of the state, or anything, by making anything the doctrine of the state. So in Turkey, do we have such a political Islam? Yes, we had that. We still had that. Now it is, I think, marginal. And that was represented by mainly this political Islam tradition. It arose in the late 60s when the center-right was continuously cracked down by the military. And it peaked in the 70s and 80s. And finally in the 90s, and it was led by Necmettin Erbakan. He's the grand old man of Turkish political Islam. And when you look at the rhetoric of Necmettin Erbakan, he's never violent, but his party basically, and I'm referring to Necmettin Erbakan and not a party, because he changed five or six parties, because he opens a new party, it's closed down, he opens a new one. The same with the Kurdish case. So this Erbakan's political line basically argued that Turkey should have abandoned NATO, Turkey should abandon its European Union dreams, Turkey should create an Islamic NATO, print an Islamic dinar, instead of a Turkish lira. So it was this kind of creating a pan-Islamic new world, and Turkey would be leader. That was Erbakan's dream and goal from the very beginning. So this is clearly against the path that Turkey has been taking since the Tanzimat, which is kind of a modernization and adopting Western norms and integrating into the Western world. But interestingly, this rhetoric did not find support in all Islamic camps in Turkey. For example, Nurcus, which is an important player in Turkish Islam. They come from Said Nursi, an Islamic preacher who died in 1960, and now represented by other neo-Nurcu groups like Fethullah Gülen followers. They're an important a player in Turkish society. They never supported Erbakan. They saw him as a troublemaker. They rather supported center-right parties like Turgut Özal in the 80s, even before that Süleyman Demirel. And so because they thought that what we need is not an Islamic grand union of the world or something. What we just need is more religious freedom. And and the center-right can give us that. And we can have this. If the state becomes less repressive, we can have that. So political Islam did not appeal to the whole Islamic spectrum in Turkey. And in the late 90s, Erbakan came to power in 1997 with a coalition government, and he really shocked the secular establishment by using provocative, making provocative statements about that a new just order will be founded, which very much sounded like a Sharia-based state. So, and the army finally again stepped in. They staged what we call the postmodern coup. In the modern days, the coups were, you know, how were they? There were tanks on the streets. In the postmodern coup, the army didn't. Well, they ran tanks on the streets in one instance, but I mean, they did not close down the parliament or arrest people, but they kind of they worked behind the scenes, manipulating the media and the judiciary to get rid of the government somehow. And finally, the government was forced to resign. So Erbakan adventure died out in 1997 with the postmodern coup. And then the reformist wing in Erbakan's party, which were not very happy with this all, you know, all this nonsense about this new world order, they were willing to find a new way. And after some soul searching, they created the AKP, today's, you know, incumbent party, the Justice and Development Party, in 2001. And in 2002, they became elected, and they got reelected in 2007 with a very strong majority, like 47% of majority. Three weeks ago, they had a local election. They lost some of their votes. They fell down to 39%. That's a local election number. But still, they are now the party that governs Turkey. And I suspect if things go, again, like 2 or 3 years from now, they might still be the party which will win the elections, the next elections. I mean, Turkey is always unpredictable, but among the players right now, I can, like, safely or not very safely assume that, you know, they might probably win the next elections too, whatever, that will take place 2 or 3 years. So this Justice and Development Party is an interesting phenomenon, and I think it presents an interesting case and a case study for people who want to study the relationship between Islam and modernity or Islam and politics. In the West, AKP is often defined as an Islamist or mildly Islamist political party, and everybody is trying to create, you know, some definition. The definition that I would prefer would be post-Islamist political party, because the party is basically coming from Erbakan's line, the prime minister and the president right now, who was an AKP member until he was elected president 2 years ago. They are basically coming from that line, but they obviously created a big shift in policy. And instead of opposing the West, they actually chose to integrate with the West. And why? That's a question. And some people say, oh, there's a trick in this. So they will go like this, and one day they will take the swords out because they're Taliban in sheep clothes. And I don't think it's that way, because I think thanks to Turkey's integration with the global economy, and we owe a lot to Turgut Özal at that point in the 80s, which opened up Turkish economy and also brought the idea of freedom, religious freedom, freedom of ideas, economic freedom to Turkey. The Turkish middle class, and especially the conservative masses of Anatolia, who are pious, started to learn more about the world. And they realized that the religious freedom that they have been seeking for a long time can well be achieved in a Western system. For example, many of the wealthy, conservative, pious Turkish families, they had daughters they wanted to send to schools. But in Turkey, you cannot wear a headscarf and go to a university. There's a secularism police waiting at the door, which stops you. They realize that you can, in the U.S., you can go to university with a headscarf. But the Anglo-Saxon, if you will, the more line, is which has more, you know, sympathy for religious freedom. So, and they said, I mean, when we adopt European norms, like, we will be able to make these reforms. I mean, the military's role will be just diminished, so it will be a more democratic country. We will be able to get the religious freedom we want under a more democratic, like a liberal Western system. So, and also you also started to have this new Islamic bourgeoisie, as we call it in Turkey right now, which has created big business centers in Kayseri, like Anatolian cities like Kayseri or Konya, and they're exporting like blue jeans to 70 countries in the world or something. And this more entrepreneurial class sees its future again with integration with the European Union and not in integration with Iraq or not integration with Saudi Arabia or, you know, or other actors in the Middle East. They have cultural affinity to Muslim countries in the Middle East. but they don't exactly want to be like them, and they believe in this more global globalization idea. There was recently a report prepared by a Berlin-based think tank titled Islamic Calvinists. It was a study about this Muslim entrepreneurs of Kayseri, and they said, I mean, the phenomenon that we saw in Calvinism way back in the beginning of capitalism, which Max Weber studied brilliantly, and showed that religiosity can be a driving force for economic progress, is also now seen in Turkish Islam. There are many businessmen who are like creating new businesses, and when they're asked why are you in business, they say, "Oh, Prophet Muhammad was a merchant," which he was. So this is different from seeing Prophet Muhammad as a warrior. Seeing him as a merchant because it's a different context, and it also gives it a more modern, if you will, or more like a trade or, you know, business-oriented Islam, which is, of course, not interested about waging an Islamic revolution, but interested about the stock market. So I think that base, that social base of the AKP, and AKP gets votes mainly from that, you know, chunk of Turkish society, Central Anatolian conservative masses, and also in Istanbul, in, you know, this new rising, you know, Islamic middle class in Istanbul and Ankara too. That, I think, base is the reason why Turkey will not become an Iran. Turkey might be becoming a bit more conservative, to be honest, because of this dominance of this new class, which is bringing its own conservative values to the table. And the old secular class are basically horrified to see these, like, women in headscarves in the nice cafes that only they used to go, and now they are there too. And it's like this class war going on. But I don't agree with the people who think that Turkey is being Islamized to a degree that it is turning its face from the west to the east. I'd rather think that Turkey is finally coming to a point in which the whole segment of the society is becoming an active actor in policy making, or in like legislating, like, or it is becoming much more democratic. The military's role is being diminished thanks to EU reforms and this whole democratization process. And the Kurds are now being represented in the parliament and they could even speak Kurdish in parliament 2 months ago, which was unthinkable 10 years ago. And probably in the Kurdish section, we will see a disarmament of the PKK and a more political argument for whatever the arguments are. I mean, there are different ideas in the Kurdish camp, from federation to like a autonomy, from secession, all kinds of ideas. But it's good if they advance it politically. So there is probably a chance for that. In the other side, the more conservative masses, which used to be looked down upon by the elite, and whose representatives were always cracked down by the military, by a coup, by a soft coup, by a stage coup, so they are now becoming more active. And Turkish society is becoming a more real society. Now, but is this a good picture? This is a messy picture, to be honest. I mean, Turkey used to be more neat in the past. Like, if you go to Istanbul, the type of people you would meet would be, like, very French or, you know, like... and if you go to Anatolia, the people will be different, but these two cities will be different. Now they're mixed. You have all sorts of people living in together, and Istanbul is probably the microcosm of this whole country, which everybody has all the different identities are coming up. Now, so is this a brand new Turkey, and what is going to come out of Turkey in the future? Well, the future is a very long period, but I can comment on the probably next 5 to 10 years. The crucial question actually for Turkey is the Kurdish question. It is the most lethal question. I mean, the debate about Islam and secularism will remain. We will be debating with each other every day whether people can wear headscarves or not. And I personally think that everybody can wear a headscarf or a miniskirt or whatever they want. It's their choice, not the state's job to define that. But that will go on, but that's a kind of a tension which can be managed within the democratic system. But the Kurdish question has the potential to turn into an ethnic conflict. I don't still find it very likely, but it has the potential to turn into an ethnic conflict, because the PKK, which is seen as a terrorist organization and hated by the 90% of the Turkish society. When you go to Diyarbakir, I was in Diyarbakir during the election results like 3 weeks ago, and it's a predominant Kurdish city in the southeast. And people were marching saying that we are PKK, we are the people. So there is this popular base, and Turkey has no way of fighting terrorism only with guns. I mean, that's a lesson that Israel should learn too, and maybe the U.S. too. I mean, at least the previous administration. But if the people that you call terrorists are not just a few hundred nihilists who are fighting crazily, and if they are rooted in a people, if they have popular support, you still have to use military means to protect yourself. But the only way to deal with such kind of terrorism is to reach a political settlement. And so Turkey's biggest issue will be to this political this political settlement, the Kurdish issue, and the nationalist Kurds, which make probably 5% of the population, have demands like an autonomy or a federational Turkey. They have the demand that their leader, Abdullah Öcalan, will be released from prison, which is going to happen. But, you know, there are very strong demands on that side. And how to reconcile these demands and how to come to terms with them is important, because on the other side, you have a very strong Turkish nationalism, which is not looking at these issues any sympathetic in any way. And which, again, brings me to my last point, which is this. Another threat to Turkey today, which is actually the mirror image of the Kurdish issue, is Turkish nationalism. Because we are seeing the rise of Turkish nationalism since the beginning of the 2000s, interestingly, as a reaction against EU reforms. And today, some people are speaking about the rise of Islam in Turkey. I don't see that as a danger. I see nationalism as a danger. Because nationalism has turned into a force which opposes anything which is new, which opposes any liberal reforms. And interestingly, some nationalists do this in the name of Atatürk. Because, to be honest, when you look at the Kemalist period in the 1920s and 30s, for me, Atatürk was a modernizer, and he did the best of his time. Like, he looked at the world, he chose the best models, he tried everything he could. For a time, he tried liberal economy, it failed, he tried, you know, state-managed economy, and so on. What happened was that after Atatürk, and even when he was alive, people turned his policies into dogmatic principles. Like, statism is a Kemalist principle in Turkey. Statism means that the state should run the economy. Now, that made sense in the 1930s when the Soviet Union was making great success with five-year plans and, you know, the U.S. economy was going down, New Deal, and, you know, all those years. But, you know, statism, state-run factories, and that doesn't make sense in Turkey. But still, that is defended as a principle of Atatürk. So I think if we understand Atatürk in a more historical sense, not in a literalist sense, and look at him as a genius which did the best for his time, but now we have to move on and maybe change some of the things he did in the 20s. I think Turkey will be much more successful in its adoption of the freedom that it really needs. And you ask about Ergenekon, so let me finally come to that. Ergenekon is an interesting case which is going in the past 2 years. It's been 2 years that the case started. It's probably the most interesting case, legal case in Turkish history. The term Ergenekon is a Turkish myth. It's a total mythology, but once upon a time, the Turks were being exterminated by the Chinese. There was one Turk left, and he went into a cave, and he had some relation with a wolf, and they had children. And that those wolfy Turks became the real Turks, and they opened up the mountains and came out. This is kind of a totally mythical, you know, which can't be biologically true at all. It is like only if you're a really diehard Turkish nationalist, you would have some, you know, feeling for this term Ergenekon. But what happened was that in the late 90s and early 2000s especially, a group started to form between some hot-headed generals which thought that the current government, the AKP, is selling Turkey to Europeans because it was giving concessions in Cyprus. And also accepting other liberal reforms and, you know, being too pro-Kurdish and so on. And on the other hand, some nationalist ideologues kind of forming an alliance and first trying to stage a military coup in the military. Like, some generals apparently lobbied in 2003 and 4 to launch a military coup against the AKP, but there were disagreements between the generals. And one interestingly said, how can you make a coup with this media? Like, there are 50 TV channels every day. Like, I mean, which one will you control? Because the last military coup in 1980, there was only one TV channel, and you control that, and you control everything. Like, in this day and age, they said, how can you make a coup? So finally, the military decided not to stage a coup because it was not, you know, really possible. And the stock market would fall down next day, and how do they, what do they do about it? But the more radical generals among that camp, then actually they were pushed away from the military. They resigned. After resigning, they formed this crazy nationalist, you know, cadre in order to force the military to stage a coup. By how? By provocations, by bombing a secular newspaper, by shooting a secular judge, so that the secularists will be alarmed that the Islamists are coming, and so we have to take something. So that is the Ergenekon case, which is going on. Some people criticize the case as the AKP's opportunity to crack down its political opponents. And I'm not sure whether there's an element of that. There might be, to a degree. Some innocent people might have been arrested. But still, many people I trust, like the more liberal commentators, think that this is a very important case, because for the first time, the people, like generals, are being on trial, are like tried for staging a military coup. Like, this is because all the generals who staged military coups, they became presidents, they became lifetime senators, and they're living in wonderful places right now. It is not a crime in Turkey to stage a military coup. You're saving the country. That's the idea. So it's the first time that Turkey is facing the fact that the people who claim to be patriots and who can be actually patriots can be also criminals. Because, I mean, you can love your country, but you can still do very bad things. I mean, all the fascists basically love their countries, but they also do terrible things to its people. So in that case, I think Ergenekon case is important. It should be careful. So not sometimes, I mean, a lot of people are under investigation, or, you know, and these include prominent, some of the university rectors and so on. And some of them might be innocent, and I hope that they will be released as soon as possible and they will be cleansed from the charges. But I think it is an important case. And I think, yes, it gives us hope for a brave new Turkey. Thank you.
This is WBUR. You've been listening to a lecture titled Turkey, Yes We Can, by Turkish journalist Mustafa Aykal. Tonight's lecture was presented by the Boston University Department of International Relations. Our introduction was given by Anthropology Department Professor of International Relations, Augustus Norton. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, WBUR.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth with help from Edward Mazulis. The executive producer for Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydotis. I'm Deborah Becker. Thanks for joining us.